130?
The closest thing to an accurate number we have is 133, but it is most definitely more than that. That's the number that the DA is giving. But just our jail support resources have made it even more than that. We had about that many people at the encampment.
And very quickly, since we only have about 40 seconds, can you describe what happened? You had just put the encampment up when police moved in?
No, we set up our encampment on 1 p.m. on Wednesday, and it wasn't until about 10:40 p.m. on Thursday that the police raided us. This is after several failed attempts to negotiate with the university. Police raided us, so for over 3 hours, they knocked my friend unconscious. He now has a concussion. They knocked an 82-year-old woman unconscious. All of my friends have bruises. They have red marks on their hands from the zip ties. And then afterwards, they bulldoze all of our things.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Ray Ferrara, SUNY New Paltz Gaza Solidarity Camp participant and student at SUNY New Paltz, Cady La Cruz, speaking to us from the University of Virginia, and Salma Hamami at the University of Michigan, graduates, just graduated, president of SJP. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, I'm Jill Fritz with the Humane Society of the United States, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune into KBOO on Friday, May 10th from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. for the live broadcast of the Blues Carnival, Rhythm in Rio. Rhythm in Rio is a benefit show for healthcare for all Oregon, featuring Norman Sylvester and Bloco Alegria. Again, that's the Blues Carnival Rhythm in Rio, broadcasting live from the Aladdin Theater from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. For more information, check out kboo.fm/Blues Carnival 2024.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our spring membership drive, taking place now through May 25th. Your contribution goes towards postmodern, avant-garde, alternative radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information at lwvpdx.org. The League of Women Voters has online voters' guides, videos, and podcasts to help voters understand the state and local candidates and measures that will be on the ballot this May. Nonpartisan voter information at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, a pro-Israel super PAC is allegedly funneling money into Oregon's 3rd congressional district race against Sushila Jayapal.
Hunger advocates push Oregon to extend SNAP benefits to immigrants.
And in national news, 8 U.S. newspapers sue ChatGPT for stealing their copyright articles.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 6th, 2024. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Ezra.
And I'm Danny Shy. The Intercept reports that the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or IPAC, is secretly intervening in the primary race for Oregon's 3rd congressional seat in Portland. That's the seat that Representative Earl Blumenauer is retiring from, and the PAC is spending against candidate Sushila Jayapal, a former Multnomah County commissioner. Federal filings show that 314 Action Fund spent $1.7 million in support of Maxine Dexter. 314 Action Fund describes itself as a pro-science super PAC, but according to The Intercept, it's actually IPAC. They cite two Democratic members of Congress who are familiar with the arrangement. Jayapal says she supports putting conditions on military aid to Israel. She supports an immediate ceasefire and would reject money from IPAC or its affiliates. 314 Action registered on April 1st, which means its donors won't become public until May 20th, a day before the primary election. Dexter is not spoken publicly about what her position is on the war in Gaza. Jayapal and fellow candidate Ellie Morales held a joint press conference on Thursday calling Dexter and 314 Action to disclose the identity of their donors. Jayapal was considered the candidate to beat before the $1.7 million in spending came in from an alleged pro-Israel group in favor of her opponent.
A Gresham stabbing victim rode to the hospital in the back of a police car when no ambulances were available around midnight on Sunday. Coin 6 News reports two people fighting at Alexander's Pub in Gresham escalated into one being stabbed multiple times. Around 12 a.m. Sunday, cops arrived at the scene to find the victim with life-threatening injuries, including a head wound and multiple stab wounds to the abdomen. The only available ambulance to take the call was in Clackamas, which was too far in light of the man's stab wounds, and this isn't a new problem. In Portland, people have been rushed to the hospital for emergency care using fire trucks, police cars, and even a TriMet bus. AMR was fined $513,650 by Multnomah County for failing to arrive at 911 calls in the required time. Last year, Robert Ketchum, a disabled senior hit-and-run victim, died in the street while waiting for an ambulance that took 32 minutes to arrive. Multnomah County also has a legal requirement for two paramedics in each ambulance, while the surrounding counties only require one. AMR, the provider for the area, maintains that it puts a strain on their staff to meet this requirement. According to AMR, quote, "The level zero event occurred due to the unavailability of our Multnomah County first responders, meaning all available ambulances were working other calls," end quote. The stabbed victim was moved into the back of a police car using a lifting tarp and was reportedly conscious the entire time. A paramedic rode in the back of the police car with him, and the victim arrived at the hospital in under 10 minutes, where he remains in recovery.
Oregon advocates are emphasizing the economic contributions of immigrants and addressing hunger's impact on vulnerable communities. KBOO's Birdie has more on Food for All Oregonians policy.
Oregon advocates are shining a spotlight on hunger and related issues ahead of the fall elections. A recent report from the Immigrant Research Initiative finds immigrants constitute 10% of Oregon's population, but contribute to 13 or more than $33 billion of the state's economic output. The Food for All Oregonians policy aims to extend SNAP benefits to 60,000 Oregonians ineligible because of immigration status. Karen Cadia-Roman of the Oregon Food Bank stresses that addressing hunger transcends mere food provision. She highlights that those most affected by hunger in her community are single mothers, caretakers, as well as individuals from Black, Brown, and Indigenous backgrounds.
These are families. Like, these are folks that are trying to make ends meet every day. These are folks that would already qualify for a lot of the safety net programs that we have in place, but just because of where they were born, they're left out.
She urges Governor Tina Kotek to prioritize the Food for All Oregonians policy in the next legislative session, arguing that access to food is a human right and that no one should be denied based on their place of birth. Raina Lopez is the executive director of PCUN, the Oregon Farmworker Union. She emphasizes the importance of amplifying the community's voice amid what she describes as a hateful rhetoric against immigrants during elections and ongoing exploitation in the workplace.
We're part of this community and that we're going to continue to do the work that is essential and continue to bring some of those urgent needs that all Oregonians are facing.
Lopez says her group, along with many advocates, are focused on five specific issues for this election, which include housing for all, a pathway to citizenship for all undocumented workers, fully funded public schools, union rights for every worker, and a ceasefire in Palestine. For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Birdie.
A group of eight U.S. newspapers is suing ChatGPT creator OpenAI and Microsoft. Those in charge of newspapers like the New York Daily News claim that the technology companies have been stealing millions of copyrighted news articles. No permission was given by the writer, and they were not compensated for their work. The alleged stolen information from these articles was used to train their artificial intelligence chatbots. Frank Pine is the executive director for the Media News Group and Tribune Publishing. He expressed in a written statement, quote, "We've spent billions of dollars gathering information and reporting news at our publications, and we can't allow OpenAI and Microsoft to expand the big tech playbook of stealing our work to build their own businesses at our expense," end quote. Interestingly, all of the newspapers are owned by Alden Global Capital. Microsoft has declined to comment on the matter of stolen work. The lawsuit was filed last Tuesday in federal court, where the companies are already facing lawsuits from the New York Times and others.
Medicare and Social Security in the U.S. will go broke in 2036 if Congress doesn't intervene. This is a further down the line than previous estimates. Social Security covers disability and old age in the United States, and Medicare is a federal health insurance program for low-income and retired residents. Medicare also covers health benefits for those with disabilities. Going broke for these programs means their reserve funding will be used up, leaving them able to cover only 89% of health expenses for patients on Medicare. Social Security would only be able to pay 83% of benefits to recipients as of 2035. Previous estimates slated the program to go broke in 2034, 1 year earlier than current estimates. Officials for both programs warn that policy changes will be required to keep them fully funded into the future. According to the U.S. News, the Social Security Administration Commissioner Martin O'Malley called a report, quote, "a measure of good news," but Congress still needs to act in order to avoid what is now forecast to be, in absence of their action, a 17% cut to people's Social Security benefits, end quote. President Biden proposed raising taxes for people with income of more than $400,000 a year in an effort to secure funding for Medicare. Americans are on board with the tax increase and want to keep Medicare running as is, studies show. However, there's been no proposed solution for Social Security. The president of Social Security Works, an advocacy group for Social Security, Nancy Altman, said, quote, "Congress should take action sooner rather than later to ensure that Social Security can pay for full benefits for generations to come," end quote. Social Security is expected to reach exhaustion in 2037.
Civil rights groups criticize police actions against student protesters, Republicans accuse Democrats of buying votes through student debt relief, and anti-abortion groups plan legal challenges to a Florida ballot referendum. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We're transitioning to be the leaders of all of these different institutions and corporations and governments, and I think we're voicing what we want this world to look like.
Northeastern University student Grace Sanford says she's disappointed her school called the cops on a pro-Palestinian encampment, where nearly 100 were arrested. Schools including Brown, Northwestern, and the University of Minnesota have so far avoided violent confrontations, in part by agreeing to study divestment from Israel. Many, including Republican leaders, have called for much harsher tactics, but other political leaders and civil rights groups are criticizing what they call the use of excessive force, including rubber bullets and mace. Philadelphia Councilmember Jamie Gauthier represents Penn's campus.
People should have the right to protest. People have the right to free speech. And there should be communication with these protesters and negotiations in good faith.
Media reports say difficult Israel-Hamas ceasefire negotiations mediated by the U.S., Egypt, and Qatar have reached a crucial stage. Domestically, 6 months to the election, prominent Democrats say President Joe Biden is striking the tough balance between students' rights and keeping order. Biden campaign co-chair Mitch Landrieu says young liberal voters should also consider other issues.
Young people have a wonderful reason to vote for Joe Biden because they're interested in climate. They're interested in their freedoms being taken away. They're interested in relief of student debt.
Former President Donald Trump told a gathering of donors over the weekend that Democrats use welfare and student debt forgiveness to buy votes. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum wants to be Trump's VP pick and describes the policies as payoffs.
Those are like, you know, hey, folks, please vote for us because we're relieving your debt. So at what point does it cross over programs like student debt to just vote buying?
Burgum says wealthy donors who want tax breaks are different because they're job creators and support Trump because they're just generous people. Burgum also agreed with Trump that Biden is running a Gestapo administration, saying if the New York DA succeeds in convicting Trump, it would be a travesty of justice. Anti-abortion groups in Florida want to prevent a ballot referendum to codify abortion rights in the state constitution. Orlando-based Liberty Council says it's considering legal challenges to the process and language. Senator Mark Rubio says the referendum is an example of Democrats' extremism.
They will never tell you which abortions should not be allowed. Okay, they're always demanding to know what exceptions do you support, but they never tell you which restrictions they would support.
Every pro-choice statewide referendum since the overturning of Roe has won, even in red states like Kansas and Ohio. But Florida's would need 60% support to pass. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
It's Air Quality Awareness Week, and today the focus is on the impact of wildfire smoke on health. Oregon has seen an increase in wildfires in recent years. Eric Tagadoff has more on the story.
This week, agencies are raising awareness about air quality. Led by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Air Quality Awareness Week is highlighting the impacts of poor air, with a special focus on wildfires and smoke today. Travis Knutson with the Springfield-based Lane Regional Air Protection Agency says small particles known as PM2.5 and wildfire smoke can cause itchy eyes, coughing, and other short-term respiratory problems.
If you are someone who already suffers from respiratory issues like you have asthma, it makes those acute symptoms that much more challenging and potentially problematic from a health perspective.
Knutson says PM2.5 can penetrate deep into the lungs. He also notes that the Northwest is seeing more wildfires, and his agency attributes that to climate change. Smoke from wildfire season is at its peak in the Northwest, starting around midsummer and lasting through early fall. Knutson advises people to check the air quality index during smoke season and says people might need to reschedule their outside activities, such as running or working out, based on the air quality.
Maybe when our air quality is bad, we reconsider those outdoor activities and instead just stay inside with a HEPA air purifier running so we are not being exposed to that harmful pollution from wildfire smoke.
On Tuesday, the focus is on asthma. Tuesday, May 7th is World Asthma Day. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $60,000 by May 25th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report with the board chair and executive director of Williams & Russell CDC about the redevelopment project for the long vacant hill block in the Albina neighborhood of Portland. At 6, it's Labor Radio. Then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 45 degrees, and tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 59. Today in history, in 1915, Babe Ruth hits his first major league home run. The quote of the day is from English dramatist Nathaniel Lee, who died this day in 1692. He said, quote, "They called me mad, and I called them mad, and damn them, they outvoted me."
Events to raise awareness on missing and murdered Indigenous people took place over the weekend, all over the country. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Events took place across the country over the weekend to raise awareness of missing and murdered Indigenous people. Some events are continuing Monday, including a walk hosted by the Yurok tribe in California. The tribe has declared an emergency on its reservation in response to disproportionate numbers of MMIP. The tribe works year-round on the issue. Earlier this year, the tribe co-hosted a summit in Sacramento and a march around the California state capitol. Philip Williams is a Yurok tribal council member.
This issue, you know, we were dealing with this. We were having some of our people being kidnapped, and we had a rash of murders that showed up on our reservation, people that I know. And we all agreed we had to do something about it.
One of those things was creating the summit.
I think one of the biggest effectiveness of this summit is that us Indian people get together. And so we're trying to raise awareness and say, we're here, and we need to be valued. Our lives need to be valued, and we need opportunities to succeed.
Danielle Vigil-Maston is an advocate and works on MMIP issues with the North Coast, California communities. She joined families, tribal leaders, law enforcement, and others at the summit, saying it's vital to continue to raise awareness.
If we don't talk about these cases and share their stories and keep it alive, then it's like it just goes away. It's like it doesn't exist. And people out of sight, out of mind, you know, that's why we put billboards up. That's why we educate people. That's why we put signs everywhere. Back in the old days, they used to have the milk cartons that everyone would see when they ate cereal. Now it's Facebook. And so we just try to get that out there. These types of events are really important.
Raising awareness of MMIP includes educating policymakers about the history of California Native Americans and the impacts of colonization, says Morningstar Galley, Director of Indigenous Justice.
We're right here at the state capitol, where the state of California was founded on the state-sanctioned murder and genocide of California Native peoples. Close by is what is known as Sutter's Fort, where it was our Miwok, Nisenan, and Maidu tribal peoples that built the fort. They were enslaved there. They were held captive. And so recognizing that this capital right here behind us put bounties on our heads, recognizing the history of California and how that still continues to affect us today.
Officials say MMIP is going in the wrong direction in the state, with cases going up instead of down, which is concerning tribal leaders who vow to continue to raise awareness and seek solutions. Joseph L. James is chairman of the Yurok tribe.
California is, unfortunately, we are the fifth largest cases of MMIP in the nation. We're trying to say no more, lawmakers. Hear us, see us, not on our watch, not in California's watch. Not Indigenous watch. There's a crisis in California, but this is not a California issue. This is a nation issue. And again, we're trying to ring that bell by bringing them to the table.
Leaders and advocates say there's still much work to do, including healing for families and tribal communities. This story is a collaboration with First Nations Experience Television with support from the Public Welfare Foundation. The U.S. Justice Department recognized May 5th as National Missing or Murdered Indigenous Persons Awareness Day. In recognition, Attorney General Merrick Garland said there's much work to do by the agency to tackle MMIP and human trafficking in American Indian and Alaska Native communities. In a statement, he said the day challenged the Justice Department to double down on efforts and to be true partners with tribal communities. The agency highlighted a MMIP outreach program to assist with unresolved cases and related crimes, promote communication, coordination, and collaboration among federal, tribal, local, and state law enforcement. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Advocates for America's National Parks are defending the U.S. Bureau of Land Management's new rules that put conservation on par with mining, drilling, and other industrial uses of public lands. Eric Galatis has more.
As critics work to roll back new Bureau of Land Management rules, public lands advocates are defending the agency's move to put conservation uses on equal footing with extraction and development. Matthew Kirby with the National Parks Conservation Association says the new rules can be used to benefit national parks, for example, by reducing pollution from oil and gas drilling on the 3.3 million acres of BLM-managed mineral rights in eastern Colorado.
Thousands of feet higher than where the actual drilling is happening. You can go up to Rocky Mountain National Park. You can't even see on some days because of pollution that's coming from drilling activities.
The rules also identify conservation tools to restore degraded lands owned by all Americans and to keep natural landscapes intact. Industry groups have called the rules a land grab. North Dakota Senator John Hoeven and Wyoming Senator John Barrasso have promised to repeal the rules finalized in April, claiming they block access to public lands and subvert the multiple use requirement under the Federal Land Policy Management Act. 90% of lands managed by the BLM remain open for oil and gas development. There are more than 31,000 orphaned wells within 30 miles of national parks, and the new rules update bonding requirements to prevent more abandoned sites. Kirby says until now, corporations have run the show.
Industry was allowed to lock up land for less than the price of a cup of coffee. They could speculate, they could develop, all at the expense of the taxpayer and the public. That was no longer actually able to recreate on that land. But thanks to this new rule, we're really on the path to fixing that broken system.
The new rules also give the BLM tools to steer any future oil and gas development away from national parks. More than 80 national park units sit adjacent to public lands managed by the BLM, and Kirby says any development impacts parks, connected waterways, and wildlife migration corridors.
Wildlife migrate across borders, water moves across national park borders, air flows in and out. So what happens outside of national parks really is critical to national park resources.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
Climate watchers and medical professionals will monitor the effects this summer's hottest temperatures could have on people at risk of certain health conditions such as stroke. A study published by Neurology found that the stroke-related deaths are increasing globally in areas encountering extremes in hot or cold weather. Terry D. has the details.
Climate watchers are predicting this summer's temperatures may set records, which could aggravate some medical conditions. A 30-year study of health records from more than 200 countries and territories suggests a connection between stroke and climate change. The online publication Neurology found the growing number of global deaths and disabilities from strokes are linked to, but not caused by, climate change. IU Hospital stroke neurologist Dr. Ann Jones says when the body feels extreme heat and sweat evaporates, hypercoagulation or blood thickening occurs. This increases the chance for blood clots. Winter weather can also produce an instinctive response.
Cold temperatures have been associated with stroke. The cold makes us kind of react with our fight or flight kind of drive, and it makes our blood vessels close down or vasoconstrict. And that can raise blood pressure up, and that can predispose you to stroke.
Jones says an ischemic stroke involves a clogged artery preventing blood from flowing to brain tissue. A ruptured artery during a hemorrhagic stroke causes blood to travel outside of the artery wall into the brain tissue. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention claims almost 43%, or 3,500 per 100,000 Hoosiers died from a stroke in 2021, and Indiana ranks 34th in the nation for the rate of strokes. The Yale Center on Climate Change and Health found that heat can increase the risk of a stroke. Recent global burden of disease studies found that 2 to 5 million deaths per year are linked to extreme temperatures globally. And climate change can also indirectly impact health through poor water quality, air pollution, and increased spreading of infectious diseases. Jones maintains good health is a start towards prevention and recommends the Mediterranean diet, consuming less red meat for optimal well-being, and getting 30 minutes of exercise 5 times per week.
Some things are out of our control, but just taking care of yourself in the ways that we can, focusing more on vegetables, fish, and staying hydrated, working on blood pressure with that reduced goal of less than 130 over 80.
The study indicates more research could identify the impact of temperature change on stroke as a way to address health inequalities, including the burning of fossil fuels, deforestation, and industrial processes.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 6th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Ezra and Birdie. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Birdie. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Terry D., Farah Siddiqui, and Nadia Ramlagan. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ezra.
And I'm Danny Shy. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be speaking with folks from Williams and Russell CDC about their community development project on the Hill Block in Albania.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I am speaking with Azalea Renfield, the Executive Director of the Williams and Russell CDC, and Bryson Davis, the Board Chair, about their work on the Williams and Russell Project and what it means to the community in the Albina neighborhood of Portland. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with us. So, Azalea, you are the new executive director of the Williams and Russell Community Development Corporation, and I want to dig into some of what your guys' work looks like. But for starters, and this is a question for both of you, what is Williams and Russell CDC?
So it is a relatively new nonprofit that was formed from the project working group that was developed through Prosper Portland, of a bunch of community members, nonprofit community leaders, to determine what to do with a plot of land that Legacy Health was donating back to the community to develop, to right the wrong of past condemnation and neighborhood destruction.
The work of this organization centers around the property on Williams and Russell. Can you talk me through some of the history there?
So the history is really the guiding part. In the 70s, the city worked with Emmanuel Hospital before it was sold to Legacy to go around and condemn and take all the property around the hospital so that the hospital could then buy it for cheap and have room to expand. Because this was the era of